it's the fantasy of the lone individual who overcomes adversity and gets to the top. And you right. too can do it, Nicole. You can do it. Just do it, right? Can.
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Hi guys. Today's episode, the last before I take a break for summer, is on mountaineering. Well, sort of. My guest, Margaret Grebowitz, is an environmental philosopher, and her latest book, Mountains and Desire, really opens up a can of worms.
I don't know if we know why we do anything anymore. I don't know if we know why we want anything anymore.
But we'll get back to this later. Margaret Grebowitz is a professor at the University of Silesia in Poland and a visiting scholar at the Center for Philosophical Technologies at Arizona State University. She's the author of four other books, Whale Song, The National Park to Come, Why Internet Porn Matters, and co-author of Beyond the Cyborg, Adventures with Donna Haraway. She's also written articles for The Atlantic, The Philosophical Salon, Guernica, and Slate. In Mountains and Desire, Margaret Grebowitz reflects on shifting responses to a common question posed to climbers. Why do you do it? In 1923, the British mountaineer George Mallory, who took part in the first three expeditions to climb Mount Everest, was asked by a New York Times reporter why he wanted to climb to the top of Everest, to which he famously responded, "Because it's there." A response that has become the iconic expression associated with the sport of mountaineering. Incidentally, for those of you who don't know this history, Mallory and his partner Andrew Irvine were last seen alive about 800 feet from the summit of Everest. His body was found in 1999, and to this day there is speculation about whether or not he made it to the summit. Climbing the tallest mountains on Earth, then and now, is a dangerous undertaking. Before reading Grebowitz's book, I knew little about the history of mountaineering. To be honest, I think if someone had asked me, I might have been a bit dismissive of the quest to reach the top of mountains, which is why I was surprised by how seductive I found mountaineering when I started to learn about it. Watch the documentary Messner, for example, about Reinhold Messner. He's the first to climb Mount Everest on his own, one of the first with his partner Habiller to do it without supplemental oxygen, and the first to climb all 14 peaks above 8,000 meters. He's also become kind of the spokesperson for mountaineering. Anyway, watch that documentary and you'll get a taste of what I'm talking about. Another must-see is Free Solo, about Alex Honnold's climb of El Capitan without ropes. That's what Free Solo means. In fact, for those of you who would like to delve into this, I'll put up a list of suggested viewing on our website, in-the-weeds.net. But before I get too carried away, let's get to the interview. I really enjoyed delving into this material. Well, I enjoyed your book, but I also, in order to prepare for this interview, I had to learn a little bit about mountaineering because I didn't know much. And I watched some of the documentaries that you reference in your book as well.
Good. I think everybody should. So you're welcome, Nicole. You're welcome.
Well, I enjoyed it. I did. It was fascinating. I mean, for one thing, you know, obviously Everest has a, let's say, a monumental reputation. And I, you know, it's one of those things that it's so obvious that you don't think about it very much. But seeing video of Everest, you can appreciate the seduction of these mountains. I mean, it's on a scale and a sort of intensity that I hadn't anticipated somehow.
Yeah. And when you see people, when you see the video of the people and when you see how they're really being pushed physically, right? How much they're actually struggling physically. That's something that's hard to imagine until you sort of see someone with, you know, their eyelashes frozen and you can see how they're struggling, you know, they're struggling in every way and they look completely different than they would look in their normal lives.
It's crazy. So you've written about quite a few different things. So tell us a bit about what brought you to this subject.
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to ask that.
Well, you talk about it a bit in the book, and I thought it was kind of a cool segue about how one of the things is that you were a fan of particularly Polish climbers as a kid. Am I right about
that? Yeah, but you know, it's the sort of thing that, you know, it's like saying that, you know, you were a fan of Michael Jackson as a kid. Of course you were. You know, it's not even like a fandom really. It's just in Polish culture of that time, right? The 80s. It was so at the center of how Poles imagined themselves and imagined excellence that everyone was a fan. Everyone knew these names. And even my family, even though we were abroad, or maybe arguably because we were abroad, we were sort of very tuned into these mountaineering accomplishments. And, you know, remember, we're talking about that very heightened Cold War moment, sort of late in the Cold War, where sports were a kind of favorite theater for this, right? Remember the Olympics in the 80s, right? Remember what happened with, you know, all the upsets in like figure skating. And, you know, when suddenly there was like, you know, the Russians would come in with some kind of, you know, amazing athlete and like take all the medals and things like that. It was the superpowers were very much sort of in conversation in sports at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a way for people in the diaspora from Eastern European countries to really celebrate their countries and have conversations around certain age-old conflicts with Russia, for example, but not only. And they were able to do it in a kind of innocuous setting, right? While at the same time, all these massive geopolitical shifts were happening. You know, martial law in Poland, and then, of course, perestroika. You're watching these massive geopolitical shifts happen, but you are able to have the conversations around sports. So it's kind of safer. It's more fun. You can be very passionate about it without risking, you know, everything. And without sort of identifying yourself too much. So these were, you know, these are the Cold War was very much a sports oriented moment.
Yeah, it's true. So you mentioned, or you implied, sort of the nationalism. I was wondering, for my listeners who don't know very much about mountaineering, if you could give sort of a quick sort of thumbprint sketch of the history of modern mountaineering. And in your book, you say that there are different ways that one could give that history, but you think there's a compelling argument to really start with the British Himalayan expeditions.
Yes.
So that was my link to nationalism. So could you just give us sort of a brief overview?
Yeah, the history that I'm most interested in is the one that identifies the Himalaya as a goal. Prior to that, you've really got the story of alpinism proper. You've got the story of climbing, of Europeans climbing in Europe. This expands sort of further and further into Asia. And then as surveying technologies become more sophisticated, it's discovered that there are these mountains that are, you know, higher than the other mountains. And people get a sense of how high they actually are. And then the question is posed, generally speaking, you know, can humans go up there? Can they survive climbing that? And all of this, as I make clear throughout the book, all of this is very intimately tied to the history of different technologies developing. And different technologies really developing in response to this desire to be up there, to get up there, to figure out how to get up there. What's the best way? To figure out how to calculate the amount of time that they would need versus the amount of equipment that they have to carry, how much water they need, how they need to sort of figure out how it's possible for the human body to do this and actually do it for the first time in human history. There had never been such endeavors before. I think Himalayan climbing is in many ways very different than European climbing was until that moment. So it sort of sets a different bar. And for me, what's fascinating is that that's when that question, you know, why do you do this? To which George Mallory famously answers, because it's there, right? That's when that question gets posed, and it gets posed on the scale of, you know, mass media. And so when we're talking about the history of mountaineering, we're never just talking about the history of mountaineering. We're talking about all these different things happening at the same time. And I think that there's a key here into culture, in general, right? So something happens in the early 20th century. I mean, something happens, to put it mildly, right? Things happened back then. But it ends up being quite a climactic moment. So for me, what's interesting is the 100 years that's passed between that moment and now. We've literally come to the point where, and again, it's not clear whether or not Mallory and Irvine summited, but it doesn't really matter. All right, I argue this in my book. The fact that they made it clear to the audiences, quote unquote, back home, that it was possible to summit, that's what sort of opens the door. And I want to say 100 years later, here we are now with that door in a way closing, which doesn't mean that people aren't going to climb.
What do you mean by the door closing? Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I mean, I can guess where you're going.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think it's not even, I mean, we can sort of see it happening, right? We can see the public outrage about the trash on Everest. We can see, you know, the Himalaya sort of closing down to tourism, as far as I know, for the first time, because of COVID-19. That's what happened last year. There was no climbing season. We can see Uluru in Australia closing its climbing trails because of the park sort of entering this new phase of collaborative management with the indigenous people for whom it's ancestral land, right? Mm-hmm. So you put all this stuff together and we're entering a new era. And it's not the era that Himalayan climbing inaugurated. It's some other era being inaugurated now. So I'm interested in mapping this as a moment.
Let's talk a little bit about the dangers. So even though the technology has certainly evolved and there are ways to reduce the risk, nonetheless, when you're talking about summiting these mountains that are higher than 8,000 meters, the risks are still considerable. So could you describe those a little bit?
Well, I mean, the main risk from again, I don't climb, guys. Give a girl a break here. I don't actually climb. So I had to do this research too to really figure out what's at stake for these athletes. But I think, you know, from what I understand, most of the risks have to do with oxygen deprivation, with hypoxia. So that's what makes the so-called death zone the death zone, right? Is that is the height at which the brain can no longer kind of recover from how little oxygen there is in the air. So you have to move quickly. And it's this kind of incredible dance where you've only got a limited amount of time before you're going to die up there.
Right. One of the things you write that struck me as interesting was you said it's sort of unpredictable to how it's going to affect certain individuals and even how it will affect someone at different times. So it's not necessarily a function of age or, you know, athletic ability, that there's a kind of unpredictability to how this low oxygen environment will affect people.
And again, you know, some things are quite predictable. Like we know that at a certain height, it's really bad. It's really bad for you. This we know. We know that sleeping up, you know, above 8,000 meters can cause brain damage. It can kill you, right? I used to hear about this as a child. I remember hearing that like someone had died in their sleep, and I couldn't figure out why. Like, why wouldn't you die when you were, you know, more physically exerting yourself, when you actually needed more oxygen, right? Shouldn't that be when the lungs give out or when the heart gives out or whatever? This is how, you know, we lay people imagine this. But it's actually, you know, it's got to do with the brain and the amount of oxygen in the blood. And apparently death often comes during sleep or in resting periods. So yeah, there are things that are quite predictable, but I think what people don't realize is how intense altitude can be at even much lower altitudes, right? So depending on what kind of body you have and depending on, you know, all the way sort of down to the level of genes and depending on how prepared you are and how much time you've taken to acclimate, you will have a very different response to altitude. So altitude sickness is the big killer from what I understand. And it can result in death in various ways, like by making you make strange decisions, for example, maybe bad decisions, worse decisions, right? By just making you exhausted. So it's not necessarily that the altitude sort of comes in and kills you like the Grim Reaper, but that it makes you sick and you can make all kinds of bad decisions that will result in falls or sleeping at the wrong altitude, for example, that will then, you know, kill you and things like that. But people in the mountains die for a number of reasons. There are avalanches all the time, right? You can fall, you can just get really, really tired, and you can just freeze to death. The more you get into this culture and sort of try to understand from the outside, speaking as a non-climber, right? From the outside, try to understand what's happening. You kind of come across these classic stories of death and survival in the mountains.
It seems to be at the center of, I mean, every narrative that I came across, you know, even those where somebody doesn't die, that threat of death seems to be so central to the story. But I wanted to mention too, speaking of avalanches, one of the films I watched was the documentary Sherpa, which was filmed in 2014, where there was an avalanche which killed, I think, 16 Sherpa. And there's something about that whole thing that is so troubling, because what they explain is that there is this, I've forgotten what it's called, but there's this, it's like an iceberg, but it's more like a kind of waterfall of ice that they have to cross in mounting Everest. And the Sherpa have to do it much more frequently than the paying clients, which puts them at tremendous risk.
Right.
And then after the avalanche happens, these helicopters come in to remove the dead bodies. And there's just this weird disconnect somehow between the amount of traffic that there is on Everest and the fact that these helicopters fly in to rescue the bodies, but there's no technology available to minimize the risk to these individuals. You see what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's no technology available because of how the whole situation is set up, right? It's set up to test the climber. It's set up to test the athlete. So of course there's no technology available, right? If you could helicopter to the summit of Everest, right? Then right. It wouldn't be the summit of Everest.
No, of course. It's just, what's interesting about this particular story is that you have the climbers who are doing it for their own personal reasons, including as a kind of feat, you know, personal feat. But then you have these professional guides who are being right. paid to do it and are taking a much greater yeah. risk. And so there's this interesting, you know, troubling sort of disparity between what's motivating these different groups of people and the roles that they play
Absolutely.
On the mountain.
Yeah.
So let's talk. So the word desire is in the title of your book, and you'll tell me if I'm steering you the right way or not, but it seems like part of what you're referencing with that word is sort of the motivation behind climbing. And you kind of trace how that's evolved. You talk about this famous statement by George Mallory when he was asked by the New York Times why he wants to climb Everest, and he says, because it's there. You mentioned that in 1953, Sir John Hunt, who was the leader of what would become the first successful Everest expedition, said that it was a chance to enter the unknown. But then as the world changes and as the experience of climbing changes, the motivations shift as well. So I was wondering if we could start to talk about that a little bit. For instance, one of the things you talk about is the kind of corporate jock climber. You know, you talk about how in commercials and in other places, climbing is used to signify not only physical prowess, but also personal, financial, and social success. So that was one example I thought we could talk about, but I'm interested in talking about this kind of evolution of the rationale behind
yes.
these expeditions.
And I don't know if, you know, it's hard to talk about human motivations or human desire in late capitalism. I don't know if we know why we do anything anymore. I don't know if we know why we want anything anymore. And that's really what the book is about, right? It's not just a sort of, you know, idiot's guide to mountaineering or watching mountaineering documentaries, which it also is. but it's, I think that watching climbers do what they do and watching these changes over time is a way for us, for all of us, everyone, to think about what's happened to motivation, right? What's happened to desire? What's happened to agency? Why we do what we do? It's very hard for me to really talk about what motivates mountaineers today, because I don't think there is any one thing. And I try to make that very clear in the book too. I think the motivation behind, you know, Arunima Sinha, that the first woman amputee on Everest, for example, who lost her leg in this horrible, violent act that happened to her, and then decided that the only way for her to kind of move through this massive tragedy in her life was to climb Everest. I mean, I certainly don't put her in the same boat as the corporate jock, you know, for whom climbing Everest is just sort of part of his corporate journey, his wealth building journey. So it's hard to talk about motivations in any, you know, unified way.
So let's go back to your earlier observation, though. You know, you say it's hard to talk about desire. It's hard to talk about what we want in this late capitalist period. So talk a little bit about how climbing allows you to illustrate that or to kind of probe that.
Well, you know, just consider the fact that mountaineers are among the most popular figures in corporate advertising. Right? You walk into a corporate office and there's like one of those inspirational posters on the wall, and it will be like the lone mountaineer standing on the summit while the sun sets, or the sun rises is actually what's happening, I think. And it's like, you know, success, never settle for less. And it's this kind of, yeah, it's this kind of logic that really kind of came into its own, I think, you know, arguably in the 80s, in the 90s, there are the studies of that 96 Everest tragedy that I talk about in the book, where the deaths on Everest that happened in 1996, that John Krakauer writes about in Into Thin Air, and then Everest became an IMAX movie, right? And sort of got onto people's radars in a new way. That tragedy is now used in management training seminars for business people, right? To show them how not to manage. It's like, if you manage badly, you're going to have an Everest tragedy on your hands. You know, the reverse of that is if you manage well, you're going to have Everest levels of success, right? So something happened where Himalayan mountaineering became kind of literally superimposed onto the capitalist imaginary, or the other way around, right? That the capitalist imaginary becomes literally superimposed onto Himalayan mountaineering. And rock climbing in the US has sort of become the site of that. There's a lot of climbing imagery used in corporate advertising, you know, banking advertising. It's all over the place, right? It's the fantasy of the lone individual who overcomes adversity and gets to the top. And you too can do it, Nicole.
Right.
You too can do it. Just do it, right?
I don't think I can. Yeah, I mean, it's the way everything gets appropriated. This reminds me of Chris Schaberg and I recorded an episode about SUV commercials, you know, where you have the SUV in the middle of, you're using wilderness basically to sell a car, where advertising has this ability to give you messages that are inherently contradictory and yet somehow embrace them. So you talk about, for instance, I went and watched the Citibank commercial from 2011 with famous rock climbers, Katie Brown and Alex Honnold.
My boyfriend and I had a big weekend planned, so I used my Citi thank you card to pick up some accessories. A new belt, some nylons, and what girl wouldn't need new shoes? We talked about getting a diamond, but with all the points I earned, somebody left the gate on. I took him to the rock I really wanted. Come save
us, a runaway train. The Citi Thank You Premier Card. Earn points you can redeem for almost anything, including travel.
The voiceover suggests that she's talking about buying, you know, things a girl would want, sort of.
Right.
There's an allusion to a rock,
yeah,
as in an engagement ring. But then the imagery shows them climbing this tall rock. I don't know where it is, somewhere in the Southwest. So it's kind of subverting this materialist sort of image of what a woman wants, but it's doing that to sell you
a credit card.
A credit card.
Yeah.
I just love that.
I mean, I think it's amazing. I just think that that ad just basically, it's like you're asking me these questions. I'm like, yo, just go watch that ad because seriously, I mean, I can't say it any better than the ad does it, right? Which is, oh, you old fashioned people who like, you know, who like all those old fashioned material things. Look at us, the new kids. We're, you know, we can do this extraordinary thing out in the world, right? And it's all also all about being outside and using wilderness imagery. Absolutely, right? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the message is Citibank.
Right.
The message is if you want to be, you know, one of the cool kids who really succeeds, right, this is how you do it.
So I'm wondering, is there a place for a less, I don't know, appropriated and maybe a less materialistic, I guess a more authentic version of what the Citibank commercial is trying to do? So I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about Free Solo, which also seems, I don't know, just like a whole knot of different things going on in the context of this documentary about Honnold free soloing El Capitan mm-hmm. in Yosemite.
Does it feel different to be up there without a rope?
It's obviously like much higher consequence.
People who know a little bit about climbing, they're like, oh, he's totally safe. And then people who really know exactly what he's doing are freaked out.
I've thought about El Cap like for years, and every year I'm like, that's really scary. I'll never be content unless I at least put in the effort. El Cap is the most impressive wall on Earth.
It's 3,200 feet of sheer granite. It's the center of the rock climbing universe.
And it is stunning. I mean, when he finally climbs it, it's just, whew,
no, absolutely.
Something else.
Yeah.
So he, you know, he lives in a van, at least, you know, through most of the film. He lives a pretty stripped down existence. I'm assuming that that represents something of climbing culture. So is there like an authentic version of that that's also going on?
Yeah. Again, you know, I don't want to be the person speaking for climbers. I don't think it's really appropriate. I think there's, whenever you've got an activity like this that compels people so much, you're going to have all the versions, right, happening at the same time. You know, mm-hmm. climbing rats, as they are called, famously live in vans for years while they climb, and they, you know, they don't hold down normal jobs. They have sponsorships, for example. I mean, if they're really successful at this, so yeah. I think we're past the point of calling things authentic, though, if you see what I mean. I think those days are over. and what's really Darn. Interesting, what I found as I was doing research on this, and I indicate this in the book a little bit, is that when you go back as far as the 50s, when those pop mountaineering books start coming out, the threat of the inauthentic climber is already present in those books. And I'm not a historian, and I'm sure historians can speak to this much better, but I wonder how far back that goes. I imagine there's a point at which it starts. There's a point at which the how-to books about mountaineering start sort of being on the lookout for, you know, what this one author calls the ironmonger, the inauthentic climber. So there's for a long time now, for at least 50 years, to my knowledge, there's the threat of the climber who's doing it for the wrong reasons. And this sense that the right reasons, what you're calling the authenticity, right? That this is already endangered and needs to be protected, that it's there. We know that that's the real stuff, right? But that it isn't, you know, it's like wilderness. It comes into existence when it needs to be protected. It doesn't really exist in the imagination prior to that, right? Or as a category to think with prior to that. So this, you know, authentic, you know, in a way we could argue that, you know, authentic climbing is born only when the inauthentic climber is right around the corner.
Yeah, no, I totally see what you mean. There's this anxiety that kind of hovers around.
And what I love, and sorry to interrupt, but what I love about Free Solo is that it really lets that tension live. And I mean, that movie is built so much around that tension, whether it intends to be or not, I don't know. But for me as a viewer, I very much appreciated that it doesn't shy away from that question. You know, it doesn't just say, well, Alex Honnold is so good at what he does that there's no question of authenticity. You know, it allows that question to kind of move the narrative along and move the climb along. And I really like that because I think it's something we're not going to be able to get away from. The anxiety around authenticity with these most loved practices and with these most loved places, right? Like these wilderness, because all of these climbs are happening in wilderness places. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be able to get away from that anymore. There's no return to a time when that's not the case.
So in Free Solo, a lot of that conversation turns around the filmmakers, right, who are part of the narrative. So one of the questions is, should you be allowing people to film it? Does it change what you're doing in some sense to have it be filmed?
And, you know, one of the writers that I really enjoyed thinking with through this process is a climber and a climbing writer named David Roberts. And in that essay I talk about, The Public Climber, Roberts says, you know, this is something that's been going on since climbers discovered that people were really interested in what they were doing. So since they started writing memoirs and sort of these accounts of these massive climbs, you know, arguably since the ascent of Everest or maybe even before that, right? I mean, by the ascent of Everest, I mean the book by Hunt, by Sir John Hunt, which comes out, you know, right after that first ascent. It's not just, I mean, you know, we could say something different happens with filming, and I think it does, of course, but climbers have been under pressure to tell the stories of the climbs for much longer than this. And Roberts argues that has to change the way you climb.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way, it's sort of at the problem of the selfie nowadays, right?
Yeah, that's right.
The problem that we all experience now that filming and sort of narrating our own existences has become such a big part of people's lives through social media. And I think everyone's aware of the kinds of distortions and changes that occur because of that. So it gives it a kind of poignancy to think about the impact that has on climbing as well. Although as an armchair climber, I kind of appreciate it in the case of Free Solo. I mean, I see both sides of it. I mean, he also, like, the other part of it is that he talks about the pressure, of course, of having the climbers there, having people watch him do this very dangerous activity. And then there's also his girlfriend whom he subsequently marries. That's another common thread, you know, the people who are attached to climbers, you know, whether it's a rock climber or a mountaineer who's engaged in these activities that are life-threatening.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, I could talk about Free Solo for hours. I think it's one of the great sort of documents of our moment, precisely because none of us are Alex Honnold, right? And that's also interesting that there's this kind of attachment that so many people responded so powerfully to this tells us something about sort of how we're built. And by we, I mean, I don't mean like the universal human psyche. I mean, we late capitalist creatures of the selfie and of the sort of desire for the authentic and desire for the wilderness, these creatures, right? How these creatures are built. And that, you know, so many of us who are not climbers and are never going to attempt anything even close to this, who are probably never going to go to a climbing gym, were so fascinated by this film. It means that the film is about something other than climbing. And the question is what? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure I know the answer just yet. You know, I'm not sure I know the answer. I feel like it's something that I'll be sitting with for a long time.
I hope you all have a wonderful summer. I plan to soak it up, and I'll be reading, brewing, researching, and planning some great episodes for the fall. If you have any suggestions you'd like to share with me, email me at askwith, that's A-S-Q-U-I-T-H, .intheweeds@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at intheweedspod, though I'm hoping some days I'll be too busy to touch the computer. Take care. I'll be back in September.